Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our Morning Talk program. My name's David Inge, and we are glad to have you with us. In 1838, the government of Britain became convinced that its empire in India was threatened by Russia. And to secure a potential invasion route, British troops were sent into Afghanistan to remove one ruler and install another. The British expected this would be a quick and easy campaign, but it turned out to be a military disaster. This morning, in this hour of Focus, we'll talk with historian Diana Preston. She tells the story of the first Afghan war, what it meant for Afghanistan, what it meant for the politics of Europe. She tells this story in a newly published book, and the title is The Dark Defile, Britain's Catastrophic Invasion of Afghanistan, 1838 to 1842. Walker is the publisher of the book, and it's a great story, both for what it says about that time and perhaps for what it says about our time. Our guest, Diana Preston, is an Oxford University-educated historian. She's the author of a number of books, including The Boxer Rebellion, Lusitania, An Epic Tragedy, Cleopatra and Antony, and also with her husband, Michael, she's co-authored A Pirate of Exquisite Mind and Taj Mahal. And she makes her home in London, and she's speaking with us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions, of course, as always, are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, so if it would be long-distance call, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. And you can also send us an email at will-talk@illinois.edu. And Ms. Preston, hello.
Oh, hello there. Hi.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's a great pleasure.
Well, it's a fascinating story. And as I say, it's a good story in and of itself. But I think that it also gives one pause when you think about the involvement of the United States and also, I suppose, to some extent, Britain in Afghanistan today.
Yes, very much so. I mean, that's one of the things which really struck me about the story. You know, intrinsically, it's a very moving and powerful story in its own right. But it also is, in its own way, something of a cautionary tale for where we are today, I think.
Well, the background here, I think we ought to start out talking about the struggle for power and influence in Central Asia that was happening now. This is the 19th, early to mid 19th century, involving the British, who were in India, and the Russians, who were not that far away.
Exactly. I mean, it was really all to do with protecting British interests in India. That's what sparked, you know, the whole first Anglo-Afghan War. We're in the period of what became known as the Great Game. This is when, you know, we have Britain and Russia intriguing against each other. Each wants to have strategic supremacy in Central Asia. The motivation for the British is, you know, as you were saying a little earlier, that they suspected that Russia had plans to try and get down into British India by advancing through Afghanistan. You know, traditionally, even if you go way, way back in history, even to the days of Alexander the Great, you know, coming down through the passes of Afghanistan was a traditional way to try to get to India. India at this stage, of course, still controlled by the English East India Company, but a very important part of the empire, very important to Britain economically. So they were determined that at all costs they were going to protect India from any advances by the Russians through Afghanistan. And, of course, that took them into this terrible adventure that was going to misfire on them, where they were really attempting to, well, it was what we would call regime change. Yeah. They wanted to make sure they had a ruler in Kabul who was favorable to them and not to the Russians.
Yeah. So here is the British are in India, and at that time there was no Pakistan. So at the on the northwest frontier of India is Afghanistan. Just to the north is Russia, and then to the further to the west is Persia, what is today Iran, which was allied with Russia. So here the British were thinking that what they needed to have was a buffer in between Russia and its ally Persia and them in India, and Afghanistan was it.
Exactly. And, I mean, this led to a lot of intriguing, I say, not just sort of for protecting the border into India, but the British were very active in Persia, as we would then call it, or Iran, as we know it today. They were very concerned that the French even, and then the Russians, were going to form alliances with the Persians and try and get into Afghanistan and through to India that way. They were also worried about some of the other rulers that sort of stood between British India and the ways into Afghanistan in the south, you know, the area that we would still call Sindh, but which is now part of Pakistan. And also there was a very martial kingdom ruled by a man called Ranjit Singh. This was the great Sikh kingdom. So the British as well had to try and get Sikh rulers on board in this sort of great adventure of theirs to try and protect their borders in British India.
Hmm. So in the Afghanistan at this time was ruled, and I guess I would want to put that in quotes because I'm interested in talking about to what extent the king, this man named Dost Muhammad, really did, how much of the country he controlled, what sort of influence he had. But we'll set that aside for a moment. He was the man in control in Afghanistan. So initially, what the British thought they could do was, if they could establish him as a client or at least a friendly of Britain, then their interest would be protected.
Exactly. And what they did was they started to make overtures to him. And one of the ways in which they did that was they sent a mission under a young man called, he was then a young man, Alexander Burnes, who was an official of the East India Company, one of their political officers. And he was sent to Kabul to negotiate with Dost Muhammad and to try and get sort of the measure of the man. And he was very impressed by him. He thought he was a capable and able ruler. And he thought that he could well be sort of brought to be a firm ally on Britain's side. What then happens is that there are various things which Dost Muhammad wanted in return from the British, which the British were not prepared to give him because they thought it might affect some of their other alliances. And they also were getting anxious about the fact that the Russians seemed to be putting out feelers to Dost Muhammad as well. And they convinced themselves that Dost Muhammad was really going to go in on the Russian side against them. I think in the end, all this proved a really profound misjudgment. They did not really understand the situation or Dost Muhammad's true motivation. It was a sort of mistaken conception that they could put their own ruler into Kabul, who would sort of do their bidding much more easily, that led them to the terrible mistake of the war.
Mm. That I wanted to go back to this question of just how much control over the country Dost Muhammad had, and whether the British were mistaken in thinking that as long as they had influence over him, that meant that they had influence over Afghanistan.
Yeah, I think you raise a really important point that goes to the heart of a lot of the problems that the British, you know, once they marched into Afghanistan, were going to encounter, because they really didn't understand, first of all, the nature of Afghan society, very tribal, very feudal, very very much a place of shifting groups of allegiances. Now, there was an overall ruler, a king, you know, we would call him a king, but the British didn't understand that concepts of kingship in Afghanistan were very different to, you know, to what we would understand by them elsewhere, you know, particularly back home in Europe. And you had lots of different shifting tribal alliances and allegiances, sometimes deciding to support the king, sometimes not. Even Dost Muhammad himself, you know, his writ didn't run that far outside Kabul, even in some of the sort of adjoining territories. There had been for, you know, the previous 80 or 90 years, and actually even going back beyond that, and this is a real sort of hallmark of Afghan history, a lot of bloodshed, a lot of civil war, a lot of tribal rivalries and blood feuds in which one major clan had attacked the members of another clan. And the whole situation there had been in flux for a long time. Dost Muhammad, at the end of a very sort of bloodthirsty period, had managed to emerge as sort of the top dog, if I call him that, rather than king, and to establish himself in Kabul. But as you say, he did not control the whole of the country, and he could not necessarily rely on people who one moment would say they supported him, because the next day, if they perceived their interests had changed or somebody else was offering them something they wanted, they could easily shift their allegiance away from him. So his position was precarious, which was one of the things which, you know, when the British started sending their missions up through the passes to Kabul, that attracted him. He realized, you know, there was huge pressure on his country, sandwiched where it was, from the different world powers. And he began to recognize, I think, that he could really do with having a protector. So the paradox of the whole thing was that he was actually looking quite favourably towards the British at the very time that they decided they couldn't really trust him.
Mm. Our guest in this hour of Focus is historian Diana Preston, and we're talking about her new book, The Dark Defile. It is about the first Afghan War, the first Anglo-Afghan War that took place in the early 1800s. And was truly a disaster for the British, the experience was. And she writes about this in the book, and it's quite an interesting story. It's published by Walker. The book is out now. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, the justification for the British invasion, essentially, was set out in a document called the Simla Manifesto. And this was something that we can trace back to one man, and certainly the people that were his advisors, and this was the man who was the Governor General of India, Lord Auckland, who made this argument that says, well, really, it's in our our, meaning the British, our security interest in India to have a regime next door in Afghanistan that's lines up with our interests. And there was this suggestion that Dost Mohammed either might decide to partner with Russia, or that the Russians just might decide to invade. And all of that was added together and bundled up to justify the British going in militarily and then carrying out this regime change. What was there really good reason to believe? Did the British really have good reason to believe either that Dost Mohammed was going to ally with the Russians, or that the Russians had decided that they were just going to do what Britain ended up doing and invade the country?
Yeah, as far as Dost Mohammed was concerned, I think the British got it badly wrong. The British government, which was based in two places, you know, British India was ruled at this time from an administration in Calcutta, as he was saying, under a Governor General, Lord Auckland. But he was also getting instructions back from his government back home in London. But you can imagine sort of what communication lines were like at the time, how long it took news and information to travel, which actually meant that people out in Calcutta, the government there, had quite a lot of autonomy from the home government. And in the same way, officials, British officials in Kabul also sometimes had to make policy on the hoof. And part of the result of the sort of difficult lines of communication, misunderstanding of the situation and the local politics, was that the British did misunderstand Dost Mohammed's intentions. I think they could have made a useful ally out of him. You asked whether there was a genuine risk of the Russians invading down into India. I think the answer to that is that there was some risk that might happen. The Russians were plainly very interested in expanding their influence into the region. They were very active in Persia. They were sending officers to help train the Shah's army, and they were getting involved in an attack led by the Persians on an outlying Afghan city in the west. They were also sending, they sent an ambassador, an officer, a young man called Vikovich, to Kabul to also talk to Dost Mohammed and to try to convince him let the Russians be his protectors and his allies. So I think that there was some risk, but probably nothing like the risk from the Russians that some people, particularly in Calcutta and in London, perceived at the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, did they must have had certainly some concerns that Persia, which was allied with Russia, was nibbling away at Western Afghanistan.
Exactly. There was constant pressure coming from Persia, particularly the besieging of the city of Herat in the west. There is constant pressure coming from there. And so the British diplomats were working very hard to try to bring the Shah over to the British side. I mean, this period of what they call the Great Game, all these sort of complexities of negotiation and trying to sort of power politics stretching right across Central Asia and down to the borders of British India, it was very complex. It was a period of not just a sort of high policy from governments back home in Europe, but you have a lot of spies and adventurers and people feeding through information. There are some fascinating characters who emerge from all of this, but of course a lot of that information was often unreliable. Sometimes it was dramatic. People wanted sometimes to tell governments the sorts of things they wanted to hear because they thought they'd be rewarded for it. But it's really, you're starting to get into a period of spies and subterfuge and secret agents. It's an extraordinary period.
Mm. Something else that I'm not completely clear about, and maybe you could talk a bit more about, was who it was that was running India. Was it, in fact, the British government, or was it the British East India Company?
Well, it had started, you know, the East India Company gets set up in the last years of the reign of Elizabeth I. So it's a long-established company. It sort of moved into India in the very early 17th century. By the time we reach the period of the First Anglo-Afghan War, the power of the company, because there have been a number of financial scandals, there were worries that, you know, it needs to be brought in more tightly under British government control. A number of Acts of Parliament have been passed to tie the activities of the company and its board of directors much more into British foreign policy. There are certain things that the board of directors are allowed to do, certain things that they're not allowed to do, and foreign policy and interventions in other countries is now very clearly in this period being run by the British government itself. It is far too important to be left as a company matter. But having said that, of course, the formal government of India at this time is still the company. You have the company having its own army in India and its regiments from that army, which are eventually going to march up into Afghanistan through the passes, to be joined by regiments from the home British army, you know, but back in the UK.
So the British decided that it was very important for them to have a pro-British ruler in Afghanistan, and that it was their judgment that this fellow Dost Muhammad was not going to be that. So they decided that they needed to get rid of him and put somebody in his place, and they settle on another man, this man named Shah Shuja. Who was he?
Yes, Shah Shuja was, he had been king of Afghanistan for a while. He was from a rival clan, if I can call it that, to Dost Muhammad. And he had, after being sort of ousted from his throne, he had gone into exile in British India. He had made a couple of abortive attempts to get his throne back that hadn't succeeded. So he was really sort of living as an elderly pensioner in British India, supported by the British. But they realized they had somebody there who had once been the king of the country, who they thought would be able to command support if they took him back there. And they decided to make him their their figurehead or their excuse for the campaign, you know, to put Shah Shuja back onto the throne. But, you know, he had many enemies back in Afghanistan, which, you know, the British had never really understood how things worked there. And he, in terms of competence and general ability, very inferior to Dost Muhammad. So they were actually taking a very weak candidate with them back to Afghanistan as their figurehead.
So in all of this, what happens to Dost Muhammad?
What happens to Dost Muhammad in the end is he receives British delegation led by this man, Alexander Burns, who at first is convinced that Dost Muhammad can be brought round to aid the British. He sends his reports back to Calcutta and to London. But others within the administration are not convinced. They override his views. They decide that there is going to be regime change. They decide that Shah Shuja is going to be the person that they're going to impose on the throne in Kabul instead of Dost Muhammad. So Dost Muhammad now starts to turn to the Russians to see whether he can get help from them, or indeed even from looking to see what he might be able to arrange with the Persians. But things are really starting to sort of move beyond his control, because just over the borders in British India, they're starting now to pull an enormous army together, regiments of the East India Company's own troops, home regiments from Britain, Sikh troops as well from the Sikh kingdom under Maharaja Ranjit Singh. All of this is being prepared, you know, to march up to try and take his throne from him. So what can he do? He now has to start to rally his troops to try and position his armies wherever he can, trying to guess which way the British are going to come, and try to confront them as they try to invade his country.
Well, the invasion does take place, and it seems that in spite of the fact that we're talking about extremely difficult terrain here, and a lot of places that an invading army would have to go where they would be at a serious disadvantage if somebody wanted to attack them. It seems that early on here, the British were really quite successful and did, I think, manage to fight make their way. I don't know how much of it involved fighting, but certainly make their way all the way to Kabul and to take Kabul.
Yes, given, as you say, the difficulties of the terrain, these wild and lonely passes, very difficult supply lines, extremes of climate, you know, great heat, but also bitter cold, all those things. Although a number of things go wrong for them at various times, they succeed in their objectives. If you look at what a British army on the move was like at this time, it seems to be quite extraordinary that they were so successful at the beginning. In a way, that sort of deluded them later on. But it almost, you know, not in any way to belittle what's later going to become a very powerful and poignant story, but you look at the army when it sets out from British India, there's sort of elements almost of Monty Python in the equipment they're taking. Some of the young officers even carrying dressing tables and eau de cologne and crates of cigars and champagne. One particular regiment brings some foxhounds with it because the officers want to go hunting. But in spite of all of that and great unwieldy baggage trains with all these camels and mules and these sort of the artillery lumbering on behind and thousands of camp followers, they do succeed in getting, with some difficulty but not too much, into Afghanistan. They take a number of fortresses on the way. They arrive in Kabul. Dost Mohammed thinks of confronting them at one stage, but he decides on the eve of battle to flee. So the British, you have them coming into Kabul and installing Shah Shuja in his fortress, the Bala Hisar, which is still there. And they think, oh, well, that's great. You know, they think we've done it. And they have been really seduced by the ease in which they've entered the country into thinking it's all going to be very easy from now on. But if you read the diaries of some of the officers who sort of witnessed Shah Shuja's entry into his capital, they could see very early on, even in the first day or two, that something was wrong. You know, the British had naively thought, well, Shah Shuja, you know, the once and future king, you know, he'll be welcome back, there'll be riotous crowds in the streets of Kabul. As he re-enters his palace, people notice that there's virtual silence. People do not welcome his return. He wasn't that popular in the first place. And what they particularly dislike, and I think this is one of the keys to sort of understanding the whole situation, is they dislike the fact that he's been put back on the throne by foreigners, by interlopers, that he has brought foreigners into their country.
Striking similarity between then and now.
Yes, very much so, very much so. I mean, again, this is something that the British in the first Afghan War simply didn't understand. I mean, they thought that they'd be able to pursue a policy in Afghanistan of divide and rule. They knew there were a number of tribal groupings. You know, they didn't necessarily understand them quite well or how the alliances worked. But they knew that traditionally lots of these groups were at each other's throats. There were a lot of long-standing blood feuds and problems. They did not realize, the British, that when faced with the arrival of foreign troops into Afghanistan, which was seen by people as a great affront, that those tribes and clans would put their differences aside for a while and they would combine against them. They just had not anticipated that happening.
Another thing that I think it's really striking here is that when you think about this, really, the invasion of Afghanistan, 1838, this is not very long after the Battle of Waterloo. And so for the British, this would be perhaps an introduction to a very different kind of warfare, something that they had no experience with, and it sounds like they were not prepared for.
Exactly. No, I mean, particularly because, as we were saying before, they'd had a relatively easy ride getting into Afghanistan in the first place. But many of the commanding officers, you know, their last real military experience had actually been, you know, on the battlefield at Waterloo. And when the Afghans started to rise against the British in Kabul, they had no way, no resources to deal with the Afghan way of fighting. I mean, essentially, the Afghans were guerrilla fighters. What the British were used to doing was the traditional thing of marching about, you know, in their red coats and forming a square. And sort of standing to a very good target, you know, standing there for a brilliant target for Afghan marksmen who had far longer range guns. They had the famous Jezail gun, which had a much longer range than the British Brown Bess muskets. So the British were using these antiquated tactics, you know, which may have worked against Napoleon, but were not going to work in a terrain like Afghanistan, and were not going to work against fighters like the Afghans.
Our guest in this part of Focus is Diana Preston. We're talking about her book, The Dark Defile. It is about the first Afghan war beginning in 1838, in which the British invaded. It's a great story. We'll talk some more after a very short break. This is Focus.
Today's programs are made possible by 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign, celebrating 26 years of fair trade. 10,000 Villages creates opportunities for artisans in developing countries to earn income by bringing their products and stories to our markets through long-term fair trading relationships.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon with 10 different topics every week. In the second hour today, the guest is Robert Trivers. He's professor of anthropology at Rutgers University, and we'll be talking about his book, The Folly of Fools, The Logic of Deceit and Self-Deception in Human Life. It's about why it is we lie, not only why we lie to each other, but why we lie to ourselves. And in fact, he makes the argument that self-deception is something that we do in order that we can better lie to others. More on that in the second hour. Today at noon, we'll have live coverage of the State of the State address. Governor Pat Quinn will be talking about possible spending cuts and his budget proposal for the coming fiscal year. So we'll have live coverage beginning at noon today. Then tomorrow, in our 11 o'clock hour, we'll try to talk about the state budget, maybe assess some of what the governor had to say and talk about the big problems that the state faces. And we will have two guests here with us. Both of them have been on this program before. Fred Gertz. He is professor of economics. He's also involved with the Institute of Government and Public Affairs here at the U of I. And also joining us will be Robert Rich. He's director of the Institute. And both of them have spent a lot of time following Illinois politics and will have some analysis for us of the state budget situation. That's tomorrow. You can check the schedule by going to our website. That's wyll.illinois.edu. You can also follow us on Twitter at Will Public Media, and you can find us on Facebook. In this hour of Focus, our guest is historian Diana Preston. She's the author of a number of books. She's written about the Boxer Rebellion, about the Lusitania disaster. She's the author, with her husband Michael, of the books A Pirate of Exquisite Mind and Taj Mahal. She's been on this radio station a number of times to talk about her work, and we're pleased that she could be with us this morning to talk about her book, The Dark Defile, about the first Afghan war. We have several callers here. We'll try to get everybody. People can help us by being brief. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Next is someone in Effingham. This is line four. Hello.
Thank you, David. You kind of preempted my statement or question about all this happening over and over again. So I'll just make it short. The past 10,000 years of Homo sapien history, and hopefully your guest can project backward that far, and the madness of males and the wars and the motives for those things, and this program is very, very, very good. And people have to understand that things didn't happen to the U.S., just out of a clear sky and 9/11. When these people have been oppressed and have been butchered and enslaved, and the same thing that the Greeks and the Romans and the predator and Alexander the Great, I was under the misconception that Alexander was a Persian, but he was not. He was a Greek, and he went from west to east. But nevertheless, I mean, the paradigm has changed little, and it has only gotten more brutal. And I'll ring off and endless in thanks.
All right. Well, I don't know how you might want to respond. I think that you maybe have some small note of caution in looking at this story, in trying to draw too much from it and saying that it is just like where we are today.
Yes, that's certainly true. I mean, it's the case that, you know, history does teach us lessons, but we also have to be wary because history does not repeat itself exactly. And I think I regard the First Anglo-Afghan War as being a story that is something of a cautionary tale. It does have some resonances for us today, the situation, you know, that we're currently at. But of course, you know, the origins of what happened there are very different to the conflict that we're in at the moment. And I know, you know, from my own discussions with friends I have, you know, serving out in Afghanistan, talking to them about their perception of things. But there are definitely lessons that we can, general lessons we can draw from looking at the First Anglo-Afghan War. And that's one of the reasons I think I found the story itself so compelling.
Hmm. Well, do you want to talk for a moment about what you think the general lessons are?
Yes. I mean, it struck me sort of, and of course hindsight, you always have to be careful with this, hindsight's a wonderful thing. Mm-hmm. But when you look back at what happened, I mean, the First Anglo-Afghan War was one of the greatest military disasters that Britain had ever experienced. You know, at the end of the campaign, we have an army trying to retreat from Kabul through the passes, under attack the whole way. We have thousands of soldiers and camp followers cut down, left to die in the snow, or taken hostage or prisoner. It's a huge disaster. But when you look at sort of how you actually got to that happening, you can see that it exercised people in Britain, politicians, journalists, in the immediate aftermath of the disaster. And, you know, they were very clear-sighted themselves in identifying what some of the messages had been, that, you know, the British had never been really clear, entirely clear about the full range of their objectives in going into Afghanistan in the first place. Yes, you know, they wanted to keep the Russians at bay, but they hadn't really thought through what that actually meant, you know, what they were going to do once they'd arrived in Afghanistan and installed their sort of puppet ruler on the throne. Was it going to be some sort of open-ended commitment? You know, so they had no really clear-cut exit strategy. And again, and that's probably one of the chief messages. And also their intelligence was very poor. They didn't understand the people, they didn't understand the terrain, or as we were saying before, they didn't understand how people would confront them, their methods of fighting. They weren't clear enough on the division of responsibilities, say, between the civilians, the political officers who were in charge of sort of the politics of what was happening, and the senior officers who were in charge of the army. I mean, those guys spent a lot of time bickering amongst themselves when they should have been paying more attention on what was happening around them. And there was also, which again was identified very quickly, you know, someone said in the immediate aftermath of the war that it was a fatal mistake of Europeans to try and introduce in sort of new and untried soils institutions, you know, political institutions that they thought worked excellently at home. The British did not understand that sort of their ways of doing things would be misunderstood and resented. You have a whole series of mistakes and misconceptions which start to snowball and lead really to what becomes, after the British have been in Kabul for, you know, 18 months, coming up to 2 years, out-and-out confrontation, with each side having lost confidence in the other, and the British having completely lost their way in what they're now trying to achieve.
Well, let us talk with someone else here who is listening, someone here in where we are in Champaign County. This would be line number two. Hello.
Hi. I have the usual involute input, but I'm just struck by this structural thing that I see between then and now, which is this idea that was just sort of promulgated implicitly that the British Empire was trying to export jolly good institutions that worked well for them. And there's a bit of that in the U.S. role, and I don't buy it. So in either instance, but putting that aside, the contemporary things that I wanted to draw to are the idea of, you know, an imperial restructuring of borders, et cetera. The successful second Afghan war was just 32 years later, I guess. and set up things with the Durand Line, and eventually at the turn of the century, and kind of set the stage for a lot of what's a problem now with the fact that the Pashtuns are on both sides of the border, and it's, nothing's going to really be solved until something like that is addressed. The other thing I wanted to start with, and I forgot, which is that, this is construed as territory on a chessboard, but to some extent, what was really at stake was the trade, I think. I'm sure they would...
Yes, that's very important.
Because
very
of this
important
chartered chartered corporation, East India, which had its purvey here, too, as a matter of fact. I know you want to respond, but I had to say something about, the U.S. role in territories. Just a few weeks ago, there was a Pakistan scholar, Stephen Cohen, who dismissed the idea that anybody in the U.S. who seriously was worried about the borders of Baluchistan. And just in the last few days, a resolution was passed by the House, and maybe we shouldn't take them seriously, calling for freedom for Baluchistan. And so I just had to throw that in there because modern scholarship can get it very wrong, even on such an issue as that. So, thanks.
All right, and I don't know, but you would like to talk a little bit more about Britain's commercial interests, and how that drove policy.
Yes, very much. The gentleman has raised a number of very important points there, particularly this question of trade, because British officials or politicians, whatever excuses or reasons they advance to justify the military actions, interventions they take, and sometimes talking about, bringing the benefits of democratic systems and everything. I mean, very often there was this was a superficial thing very often, and it was a mask for other motives. And a key sort of feature of this period, in fact, it's a key element, isn't it, of the whole expansion of the British Empire. It's not about aggrandizement in terms of grabbing land so much as about trade. And in this period, the British are extremely interested in gaining access to Central Asian markets. They want they want to be able to sell manufactured goods made in Birmingham and Manchester in the UK in the markets of Bukhara. So one of the things about having a pacified, pro-British Afghanistan is not just sort of to protect British India, but it's then to boost British trade. You're having raw materials being sent back from the empire to be processed back in Britain. You have a lot of manufactured goods for which Britain is very actively and aggressively seeking foreign markets. And one of the great rivalries this period was that the British perceived the Russians squaring up to them in the markets of Central Asia to have supremacy over trade. So this was a very important factor in what was going on.
All right. Again, I want to thank the caller. Others are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, maybe in a bit we can talk a little bit more about the second Afghan war, but just to round out the story of the first. So what happened was, so the British go in, they manage with enough military force to take Kabul and to install this man, Shah Shuja. But it must have, at some point, and not long after that, become obvious to the British that they were surrounded by hostiles who were not happy about them being there and were not happy with Shah Shuja, and that there was no way that this man could hold his position without very significant military support from the British. At what point did it seem that the British position really was untenable? They realized it was untenable, and then they made what turned out to be this disastrous decision to leave.
Yes, I mean the British, first of all, they established themselves relatively easily in Kabul, which Shah Shuja sitting in his palace within the fortress. They think everything's going to be all right. They install their troops in some cantonments, barracks outside the city, which are really very difficult to defend. Instead of putting them anywhere proper, they start to come under pressure from the government back in London and in Calcutta to cut costs. The government back home perceives the campaign as being sort of nearly over. They think it's all happened, it's all gone well. Why not start to withdraw troops? So, in the immediate aftermath of the reinstallation of Shah Shuja, you have the first regiments returning back to India. But it then starts to become very clear to the military officers who've been left behind in command that they simply don't have enough troops to do more than maintain garrisons in a few places. They start to worry about, you know, what is going to happen should the tribes start to ally against them. So they have those concerns. On the other side of the spectrum, you have the political officers now starting to enter into alliances and to do deals with some of the tribal chieftains, you know, as a way of gaining some sort of security for the British presence in Kabul. And these officials, I think, on whose shoulders rest a lot of the responsibility for the disaster that's about to happen, they really do view the situation through rose-tinted spectacles. They think they understand the politics of the place. They think that they can do deals. They make at a particular stage, when the British have been there for over a year and things are starting to sort of fall apart around the edges, they make the fatal error, and it's a sign of overconfidence, in response to pressure from the home government, they cut the subsidies that they had agreed to pay to the tribal chieftains for keeping the passes out of Afghanistan back to British India open. You know, we have to remember sort of the geography of Afghanistan. It's this remote mountainous kingdom, which can only be accessed by a number of, few number of routes. These passes are absolutely crucial, and the tribes who control them, who have been used for centuries to being paid a fee to allow caravans or whatever it was to pass through. But the British foolishly cut the subsidies. The tribes say, OK, we hear what you say. They go away. And the next parcel of British troops that try to move through the passes get attacked. The British start to realize now that the tribes are rising against them. They still try to do deals. And the senior envoy, again, in a misunderstanding of the situation, tries to sort of play power politics with the tribes, setting one group up against another. He misjudges completely. He becomes perceived as just being completely duplicitous, particularly when he even gets involved in commissioning, you know, what we would regard as a couple of political assassinations. Really, from the moment this is discovered by the Afghan chieftains, they ally themselves against the British. They decide they can't trust them. The first attacks happen on the British living in the city. A couple of people are murdered. Their bodies are displayed in the bazaar. The British then retreat into their barracks. They wonder what to do. You know, can they withdraw safely back to India? Can they still manage to negotiate with the chieftains to stay on? Because now winter is coming. Can they stay on till the spring when it will be safer to try to leave? All options gradually close off. And in the end, they have to negotiate on the Afghans' terms a retreat out of Kabul, with they'll be taking with them about 4,500 soldiers, about 12,000 camp followers. A lot of those people, women and children, are talking about a journey to get out of Kabul back to a British military post on the borders, a journey of some 90 miles in very, very bitter winter conditions. I mean, we've just had that terrible news this week of a number of refugee children in Afghanistan who've died because of the severe cold at the moment. It was in January that we have the British trying to begin their withdrawal. As they enter the passes, they're immediately attacked by tribesmen. There are various attempts to negotiate as they sort of move on through the passes, which now become strewn with these, literally, if you read the accounts in the diaries and letters, it's very gruesome, these thousands of bodies piled everywhere. The upshot of all of this is that apart from a few people who get taken hostage, including some of the officers' wives, only one European gets through to the British military station at Jalalabad that they've been trying to reach to tell the extraordinary story of this disaster. So the whole situation for the British has deteriorated and ended in terrible disaster within the space, I suppose, really of no more than about four and a half months.
Now, there was, as there we have referred to the fact that there was, this was the first Anglo-Afghan war. There was a second that was not all that long after that. And in that particular case, the British did achieve their, what was the objective of the first war. What made the difference between the first and the second?
I think What made the difference in the Second War, we're now sort of talking about 1878, 1879, is much more decisive military action. I mean, I think the British had learned some lessons from their first experience in Afghanistan, that they were not fighting Napoleon's troops at Waterloo any longer. They were in a very different situation. The commanding officer, Brigadier Roberts, was much more competent than any of the senior officers had been in the first Anglo-Afghan War. But having said that, you know, this Second War was, again, not without its disasters and its sort of misconceptions and misapprehensions that sort of constantly seemed to bedevil adventures into Afghanistan. Because, you know, the British had intervened again because they'd heard that the Afghan ruler had accepted a mission from the Russians. They didn't like that. They demanded the right to send their own mission into Kabul. And so they do send an envoy. And he sends, you know, a very chirpy telegram back to London that he's arrived safely in Kabul. He says, you know, all is well. I personally believe that the ruler will turn out to be a very good ally of Britain. Early the next day, with rumors sort of circulating the city that the British have arrived with all sorts of ulterior motives, including perhaps even trying to convert people to Christianity, the people in Kabul rise up and they murder the envoy and his mission. And this then provides this is the catalyst for another army now to advance into Afghanistan. We have the Second War. But again, it all starts really through mistakes and misconceptions. Mm. It has a better outcome militarily for the British, but it, again, you're in a situation which, again, you know, as I say, beware of hindsight, but looking at it, could have been avoided with you know, better perceptions of things, better intelligence.
We have just a couple of minutes left. If somebody, we did have a caller, and they rang off. So if they wanted to call back real quick, or if someone wanted to call real quick, I think we could try to get someone in. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. So tell me, that I know that you have, in telling the story, you managed to take advantage of written accounts, diaries, things that people left where they wrote about their experiences to try to really bring this to life. And that's where you get some of these accounts of just how horrible it was for the people that had tried to leave and had gone through had gone through the Dark Defile, which is a reference to an actual place. Are there particular individuals that emerge from this story that you find fascinating and compelling?
Yes, there are some amazing characters. I mean, we have letters and diaries both from people who died at various stages during the events in the book, and also, as you say, from survivors. There's, in particular, a wife of one of the senior officers, a woman called Florentia Sale. She survives the retreat down through the passes, even though she's hit a couple of times by musket fire. She's taken into captivity. She spends 5 or 6 months sort of bundled from mud fort to mud fort by her Afghan captors. But throughout this period, she keeps a very frank, unsentimental, clear-eyed account of what is going on and her feelings about it, and her feelings about how the British have allowed themselves to get into this mess in the first place. Very, very frank, even down to the details of not just sort of the heroics in places or the drama, but the homely little things that tell you so much about human nature, how even in captivity, after everything they'd experienced, some of the women were not prepared to lend thread and needles to other women. To help them out. You know, these little sort of insights into people living under stress, but sort of human nature still asserting itself, I found extraordinary. And we also have accounts written. There was a young Indian, a man called Mohan Lal, who was an agent on behalf of the British and very much involved in trying to negotiate with the tribes. And he tells, again, in his account, a fascinating story of some of the underlying politics of what was going on. It really brings it alive. You can see how people thought and felt and reacted and why sometimes they made the mistakes that they did. But these, you know, all these letters and diaries, they really do make it such a living, compelling story. Mm.
And was anyone really held by the British government really held accountable for bad decisions that were made?
Yes, the Governor General, Lord Auckland, who had signed, you were talking, you know, about the document which set all this rolling, the Simla Manifesto. Mm. His reputation suffered very badly as a result of what had happened. A lot of the blame, though, was placed on the senior British envoy in Kabul, a man called Sir William McNaughton, who had really, you know, it's interesting, you were talking about self-deception a little earlier.
Mm-hmm.
He had deceived himself, perhaps because he did indeed wish to deceive others, about what the true situation in Kabul really was. He wanted to believe the British would be successful there, that he would leave it sort of a pacified country that would be a good ally of Britain. And it was thanks to his reports that the British government back home in London and elsewhere really found out far too late just how serious the situation was. But of course, he paid a terrible price for that because he was murdered during some negotiations with the Afghan chiefs. So he didn't survive. But even though he'd been one of the victims, he was very much blamed in the aftermath, as you know, Parliament and the press and the public all demanded to know what on earth could have happened to have contributed to this disaster. And he was one of the people who was particularly blamed.
Hmm. So I know you've certainly written quite a bit about British colonial history. Was there something in particular that drew you to this story in the first place?
Yes, I've been interested for a long time in, military disasters and how people sort of react in them.
Hmm.
And I'd started reading the diaries of some of the people involved in this, particularly the woman, Florentia Sale, that I was talking about, because I find the whole sort of psyche of people in that period absolutely fascinating, because sometimes you really do feel, yes, you're reading about something which happened 170 years ago, but sometimes what they write, how they describe dilemmas, moral, whatever they were that they faced, it is still so real to us today. There's so much relevance comes through stories like this. You know, when I'm looking for a subject to write about, I am a storyteller. That's what I look for. But I also want to find something which has some resonances. You think we learn not necessarily even about history, but about ourselves, maybe.
Yeah.
And I thought that this was a particularly emblematic story. And the more I read about it, you know, the more hooked I became.
Well, the story is told in Diana Preston's new book, The Dark Defile. It's about the first Anglo-Afghan War, 1838-1842. Walker & Company is the publisher of the book. It's just out now. Ms. Preston, thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much indeed.